Ladies and gentlemen, with that gavel, I have convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for February the 20th, 2018. We are here today for public hearings and work sessions. The House will be leaving us at 1:45. We are still awaiting amendments for House Bill 4005. So we are going to start with the two work sessions that have to do with ODOT and try ODOT to do this in 15 minutes. So I'm going to open up a work session on Ignition Interlock Device Oversight Program, House Bill 2638. I'm going to open up a work session on Transportation Package Implementation Report, House Bill 2017. I will also open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4005. And finally, I will open up an informational session on the transportation package positions and expenditure limitation requests. And I presume that we are convening while we have a quorum, and we'll take up that informational after we lose you all.
So we have two senators.
I see we have two senators, and I don't know if they're here to testify on amendments that we don't have.
They should be posted now, Madam Chair, and you will have them. The fiscal schedule prepared.
Okay. Well, I will. Now that you've completely screwed up my schedule here.
No, it's not my intention, Madam Chair. I'm bowing your discretion.
Well, we have to wait an hour on those anyway, so I think we're going to stick with the plan. With respect to colleagues, I'm going to ask ODOT to come forward and get these work sessions out of the way. ODOT, you got 15 minutes. Good afternoon, Mr. Costales.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Troy Costales, Administrator of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and here to report to you on House Bill 2638 from the 2017 session around ignition interlocks. There was a budget note associated with that bill asking us to come to report to you during this session related to how the program and fee process is going. Just a quick summary, we are working hand-in-hand with OSP, Captain Fugate here representing Oregon State Police, on this program. We are moving forward with hiring the limited duration positions you gave us authority to do. We've also met with the vendors in the state of Oregon on the interlock devices and have set in motion the beginnings of an administrative rule process to deal with the fees, establishing the fees in a way that they will cover the administrative costs of the Oregon State Police program once it's transferred to them by law July 1st, 2019. In the interim, my program is using alcohol impaired driving funds to cover our initial startup costs so that all the revenue raised will transfer to Oregon State Police on July 1st of 19 to cover their program.
Mr. Costales, I got a quick question to ask you. Are you going to be able to get fees to cover OSP's expenses that aren't going to be crippling to the people participating in this program?
Madam Chair, yes, we are.
Thank you.
So that brings a summary to the program that we are working cooperatively together with a goal of doing our rules at the same time so that all of the vendors and participants know what's happening with ODOT as well then with OSP when the program transfers.
Thank you. Yep. Does that conclude your report?
My report.
You're the soul of brevity. Colleagues, any questions for Mr. Costales? Mr. Fugate.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Do you have any comments?
I'm just up here to get his back. Everything's going great, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We're moving along great, working collaboratively, and we're on course to get this program up and running.
Perfect. We'll hear from LFO, please.
Madam Chair and members, the LFO has received and reviewed the report and is recommending the subcommittee acknowledge receive the report.
Thank you. We're in work session.
I understood that, Madam Co-Chair. I move that we approve the recommendation to accept the report.
Colleagues, you have heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? The report is received. Thank you, gentlemen. And we will need carriers.
No.
Okay. No carriers.
No carrier.
Okay. Next, we're going to invite Mr. Mather and Mr. Garrett. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Team ODOT set a great pace.
Fair enough. We'll keep running. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. With me is Paul Mather, the Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. We come here today in response to a budget note that was embedded in House Bill 5045, passed in 2017. That was the budget bill that implemented House Bill 2017. Three questions that were asked in that budget bill. What's the progress in filling the 2017 approved positions, I will tell you, of the 35.63 FTE or 51 positions approved in 2017, 23.40 FTEs or 35 positions are filled. We have three offers out pending acceptance letters, and the remaining positions are in various stages of recruitment. So we're moving forward on that front. The second question asked in the budget note was an update status report on projects, highway projects. While there were no highway projects scheduled to go to construction until the summer of 2018, much preparation has been engaged. First and foremost, our commission has adopted all the projects that were embedded in House Bill 2017 into the statewide transportation improvement program for the years 2018 through 2021. Adopting those projects into the STIP allows us to do the preliminary work to prepare to move to construction. So what does that mean? We have engaged in several activities specific to the local government projects that are embedded in 2017. We have signed an IGA with the Port of Hood River. They're looking to replace that bridge. We have and are in negotiations on some jurisdictional transfers in Lane County and the City of Eugene. We have three projects. The Prineville Tomacall Roundabout is under contract and will go to construction in the very near future here. We have two projects, one in Troutdale, the other on the I-5 corridor, the I-5 traffic management, as well as the I-5 I-205 corridor bottlenecks projects that are in design and, again, will go to construction later this year. The I-205 Abernathy Bridge Freeway Widening Project, we have delivered the cost to complete report that outlines the cost, the project scope, the schedule, as well as the phasing approach to deliver that that significant project on 205 by 2025. We are updating all our agreements with the Oregon Travel Information Council as they are to receive six additional rest areas and funds to provide upgrades to those facilities. The dedicated projects that made up the multimodal, you've heard about intermodal facilities. We received six pre-proposals. Three are moving through the process. One proposal for the Treasure Valley intermodal facility. Two proposals for the Mid-Willamette Valley are still moving through the process as that effort moves forward.
Mr. Garrett, I am going to stop you because this has come up in the Transportation Committee as well. Talk a little bit about the selection process for those intermodal facilities. Who's on the selection committee? What are the criteria? Are they objective criteria? Are there preferential points? I mean, I don't know either of the sites well. I've been to the Ontario one, I understand, and one of the competitive sites are Millersburg. There are two big railroads that cross there, one in another place. Tell us a little bit about what criteria you're using.
I think the criteria first is the completeness of the pre-proposal that came in. Again, six applicants sent out information saying we have projects that should compete, or we believe should compete for these multimodal investments, specifically the two intermodal facilities. We also look at the adequacy of the and the qualifications of the project sponsors. So what we had were ODOT professionals, some in our rail division, some in our freight division, and then we worked with our partners at the Oregon Business Development Department as well to bring their professionals to eyeball, again, the completeness of the applications as well as the qualifications. Went through that process, again, we identified and threw out some that weren't complete. Again, we challenged some that because we didn't believe the project sponsors were qualified. That moves us forward to the one proposal for the Treasure Valley facility, the Treasure Valley Reload Center sponsor, which is the Mohawk County Development Corporation. As Chairman Johnson indicated, there are two competing for the Mid-Willamette Valley Intermodal Facility. That is a Millersburg sponsor known as the Lynn Economic Development Group, and then the Oregon Shipping Group, which is the sponsor for the Brooks Hopmeer submission. All three of those, again, as I said, were deemed complete and adequate. So now we're beginning conversations with those folks. We have to come to an agreement where they start to share exactly what the terms, the expectations, the cost, the schedule of the next plan that moves forward. That's identified in the administrative rules. What we're looking for in these project plans, and would ask the sponsors to populate, are detailed site locations, a detailed work scope of the activities, necessary site ownership, commodity market analysis, market share, full financial statements, job growth. Those will be scrutinized, again, by ODOT professionals, by Business Oregon professionals, as well as an independent set of eyes. We're going to bring the private sector in to give another level of scrutiny. We take that information, we inform it, then we seek to move two projects forward. As the bill indicates, there needs to be one site at the Treasure Valley area, in the Treasure Valley area, as well as one site in the Mid-Willamette Valley area. So the scrutinies continue, Madam Chair. We also have activities engaged in terms of a rural advisory committee for safe routes to schools. Again, there was a $10 million infusion to safe routes to school. That increases in 2023 to a $15 million investment for those infrastructure type projects. We are, as I say, in the rulemaking process with our advisory committee. Those draft rules are expected to be and come forward to the commission in the April-May timeframe. I think with that, Madam Chair, very quickly, I think it takes us to the third and I think the most significant question here. We understand the 2018 legislative session here is to address the positions and the limitations for only the 2017-2019 budget implementation period. With that understanding, ODOT requests the legislature approve an additional $195,882,485 in budget limitation and 77.63 FTE or 179 positions for the 2017-2019 biennium. We know there are additional conversations that will play themselves out as we move forward into the 19 session. Well, we'll have that 19-21 conversation. This request positions the agency to deliver the highway funding or the highway projects that have been funded in the bill, as well as the maintenance and operation activities, transit investments, as well as the accountability disciplines and scrutinies that were applied in the bill. I believe you have a chart that walks you through some of those initiatives as well as the sections of the bill. Madam Chair, I have Mr. Mather up here because the largest portion of that request is specific to project delivery. House Bill 2017 increases our contract volumes by 51%. Okay. So if you look at the 18-21 STIP, you'll see our volume has moved from about $370 million a year to about $560 million a year. So significant infusion of money. So I've asked Mr. Mather here to dive deeper into any details or issues you may have within the project delivery portfolio. I think with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand down.
Okay. Mr. Mather, how much of the material that you would offer now would you offer in the informational segment? And while you collect your thoughts, House members, I've just gotten notification from Mr. Alderson that you are excused from the floor session. You will be called as needed. And so you all have special dispensation. We told the legislators that they were going to be on at a time certain, 1:15. So... Okay, and here's the latest incoming news. House Bill 4005 A23 were posted at 1:01 p.m. We can discuss these at any time. However, we cannot accept any motions until 2:01. So, all right, Mr. Mather, how much could you reserve for the informational session?
Madam Chair, I'll reserve my remarks till then.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You're done with your remarks, Mr. Garrett?
I am.
All right, colleagues, we had opened up a work session on the transportation package implementation report that you have just heard, and would hear from LFO.
LFO recommends the subcommittee acknowledge receipt of the report.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Madam Co-Chair, that sounds very good to me. I'd move approval of the recommendation to acknowledge the report.
Colleagues, you have heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion to receive receipt of the report. Any questions, any discussion, any objections? We will receive the report, and we do need carriers. And Senator Monroe, I think you volunteered on the internet interlock. Is there a volunteer on the House side, or would we defer to our former police officer?
Sure.
Okay, Representative Noble on the House and Senator Monroe to full and to the Senate. And
transportation package,
we need carriers on that.
For the report.
I'd help.
Senator Monroe.
Actually, Senator Hansel.
Senator Hansel, sorry. And Co-Chair Gomberg. All right, so we'll close that work session, and we will now, I've already opened a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4005A relating to the price of prescription drugs. We are going to take testimony. It is going to be very truncated testimony because everybody wants to say something about this bill as it has been evolving. We will invite Senator Steiner Hayward, and what happened to Senator?
I don't know. I texted him. I told him to come. But worst case scenario, I can do this.
Okay. We welcome Ms. Toe from LFO. And we're going to, we don't have that many people signed up. Anybody else feel the spirit of testimony moving in them? All right. There being none, we're not at quite such a frantic pace. And so.
There's one in the back there. So.
Are you
in the very back?
Chair, are you referring to House Bill 405?
I am. Okay, there's a sign-up sheet. Have you signed the sign-up sheet?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, then we're good. All right. So, welcome, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17, and it's a privilege to come to you today to talk primarily about the A23.
Please, Senator Lithicum.
I just started. The A23 amendments to House Bill 4005. There are, I believe, several other amendments that are under consideration. I believe the 10s, 13s, and 15s, but I've kind of lost track at this point. Senator Linthicum and I just want to talk to you about the A23s. House Bill 4005, as I believe you know, is a bill to increase transparency on the prices of prescription drugs. We all know that prescription drugs prices are rising much more rapidly than the general cost of health care, more rapidly than inflation, and are doing so for reasons that are largely inexplicable to most of us. We believe that by creating this opportunity for transparency in this industry, by having the state play a role similar to not the rate setting part, because we aren't setting prices for this, but the transparency part that DCBS does with the insurance industry, that we can start to get a better handle on this. That being said, we believe that this is a multifactorial problem and that we need to understand the economics of the entire supply chain, which includes not only the pharmaceutical manufacturers, but the wholesalers, the insurance companies, the prescription benefit managers, and the pharmacies. And so in order to start to look more detail at that, Senator Linthicum and I, along with help from many others, have come up with the A23, which I'd like to describe to you briefly, if that's okay with you, Senator.
Sure.
Thank you very much. The A23s stick with the base bill with one minor exception that I'll get to in a second. But they add in, starting on page 4, 5, sorry, I've lost track of the pages. Page 7, Section 10 of the A23s establishes the task force on the fair pricing of prescription drugs. And this will be a task force that will have a very, very rapid time frame to do its work. We will be, Madam Chair, be including an e-clause now on this bill so that we can get the task force going. The main part of the bill doesn't take effect until January 1st of 2019. But the e-clause allows the task force to move forward, which is why one has been added to this bill. And that's clear in the bill that the main part is delayed. The task force would have all the usual suspects, exactly who you would expect to be on this task force. And the charge of the task force is the task force shall develop a strategy to create transparency for drug prices across the entire supply chain of pharmaceutical products, including but not limited to manufacturers, insurers, pharmacy benefit managers, distributors, wholesalers, and retail pharmacies. And I want to thank Senator Linthicum for his work in crafting that charge. It's much better than what we originally had, and I appreciate that. And the goal is for this task force to have its first report out no later than November 1st of this year, with the idea being that that would allow us to advance legislation in the 2019 session while already having the fruits of the that would help us get ready for the work that would be happening in 2019. The only change to the main bill itself with the addition of the A23s is postponing the date that the manufacturers first have to report on all the things that they're supposed to report on. And in the first year, we're moving that from March 15th to July 1st.
We believe that that will allow everybody to come to the table in good faith to figure out whether the plan put forward in this bill is our best option or whether we should modify it, add to it, change it in some way. And we want to have the opportunity to do that before we're asking the manufacturers to submit one round of information. We want to make sure we're asking them to do the right thing. Assuming that we move legislation forward in 2019, we would adjust as appropriate whatever was going to take effect based on 4005. That's pretty much it from my perspective, Senator Linthicum.
Thank you. Senator Linthicum, again, we're under time constraints. That took 5 minutes, and we've also been joined by the bill sponsor, Representative Nose.
Oh, Representative Nose, I'm happy to give you my space.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just cover on a few things. You've heard the main thrust of this, and I need to be very explicit in this. We have been describing a problem that exists in the healthcare world. In the healthcare world, we are all aware that costs are rapidly exceeding our ability to pay. This is, I've likened the healthcare thing to The Blob, the Steve McQueen movie, you know, and unfortunately, it's not in the Arctic like the movie version, but it's right here in Oregon. And we could have used your helicopter expertise in helping us drop this somewhere in Antarctic or whatever, but it's right here with us. And it reminds me of the water cooler joke. If you think things are expensive now, wait till government gets involved, and that's where we're at. And nobody seems to know the whys, the wherefores, the why nots, and the how-tos. This bill is designed to address those issues. It is, even President Trump, if you'll recall, in his State of the Union, he said one of my greatest priorities is to reduce the price of prescription drugs, to fix the injustice, he called it, of the price of drugs. It will be one of my administration's top priorities. It's not so much an injustice, but it's unjustifiable price gouging that we see or not. See, that's the key. We don't know. Is it legitimate price structure? Is it illegitimate? We need to find out. And there's a lot of relationships. There's contractual relationships that govern the pharmacy benefit managers, the pharmacies themselves, the wholesalers, the retailers, the manufacturers, all of those guys are in this. And what we don't know if it's fair or not fair. And this legislation is simply going to pry the lid off of some of those things so that we understand those relationships and can make an accurate judgment with how we spend OHA dollars. So it's important to keep the insurers there, the pharmacies there, in terms of retail outlets and giant pharmacy chains, as well as the middlemen, the PBMs, as well as those who actually are manufacturing these products and setting the prices and the wholesale acquisition cost in those items. There's a lot of moving pieces. I look forward to working with this to provide a cost-effective and enforceable solution for exposing the nature of this product line, what the commodity chain looks like, and how Oregon can best manage their resources to supply these products to constituents. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions of Senator Representative Nierman?
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Linthicum, I'm just at a very high level. I just haven't had time to work on this amendment here. But so my problem with the original bill, or the A and Gross version, was that it put transparency, the burden of transparency, on the drug manufacturers, but not on the PBMs and the insurers. Does this amendment include PBMs and insurers in that scrutiny?
It does not specifically include them, but that is the focus of the task force.
Understudy, then.
Yes,
okay.
Right. Understudy.
Mm-hmm. Representative Noble.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Senator, I noticed in Section 10 at the beginning where the task force is established, it says the task force is called the Fair Pricing of Prescription Drugs, which seems to be different than the actual objective outlined in subsection 3, where you're talking about promoting transparency. Is this task force in any way related to price controls, fair pricing, imposition by government? in any way, could it ever be construed that way?
Thank you for your question. And Madam Chair, no, it has got nothing to do with price controls. It is about exposing prices that may sound risky in today's world, but it's about transparency so that we see the legitimacy of the price constructs or the unfairness of those price constructs. What we're looking for is fairness. Whether they are or aren't isn't for debate here, and we don't plan on setting that. What we need to do is have enough transparency so that the consumer has sovereignty, so the patient has personal responsibility and patient responsibility for how they are going to provide access to the formularies that are created and provided by their insurers, by their payment plans, by their HMOs, by their participation. All of these features are better dealt with a knowledgeable public and knowledgeable policymakers. Without that knowledge, we're left blindsided.
Representative Noble.
Oh, thank you. The other question I have is timelines. The task force is supposed to have a report in next fall. If we can't get anything solidified for the legislative session that needs to be changed, do the timelines still kick in? And I guess the meaning is if what we have in the first part of this bill is not where we want to go with the task force, are we still stuck with implementing what we have?
Can I help with that one? Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Noble.
Would you identify yourself for the
Elizabeth
record?
Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate. The task force, first of all, doesn't actually sunset until the end of 2020. We believe that the task force will do some significant work this year and hopefully create a next step forward, but we also believe that based on whatever we do in the 2019 session, we will have to do more, which is why the task force will stay in existence, assuming we all agree it's needed, for another year and a half after the 2019 session. Yes, is the bottom line. To be blunt, if this task force doesn't succeed in coming up with a better solution, what will go into effect is exactly what's in the base bill. And the only exception is that the first report from the manufacturers won't be due until until July 1st next year. After that, it'll be March 15th. Everything else will be as it is in the base bill. Frankly, our hope is that the fact that knowing that it'll be there will be make it a lot like the surprise billing issue that we had a deadline on for people. We passed legislation last year, and it was very effective in bringing everybody to the table. You'll be seeing legislation we passed off the Senate floor on that issue soon.
Senator Hansel.
My question was sort of what along Representative Noble's line. I mean, you got a base bill, and in the base bill, you're mending in this task force. Why don't we just go with a task force and then work on the base bill in the next session? It seems like it's counterproductive. I mean, you've got a more controversial bill that not everybody was a part of putting it together, and the task force is supposed to do that. Let's just go with the task force and get ready for the long session.
Madam Chair and Senator Hansel, thank you for the question, and your point is well taken. At issue is how do you get a handle on this? And if you'll think of the manufacturers as the first guy in the lane, they're the number one pin in the bowling lane. And they create a product, they do the R&D, they do the investment, they generate profit that then becomes that investment for that R&D. It probably takes $2 billion to even have a legitimate go at R&D for new pharmaceuticals. Nevertheless, they start the ball rolling. So they set the initial price, they establish the WAC, they cause the chain of events to start. So it's perfectly legitimate to identify that number one pin and then pick up all the other Skittles in the lane. I think it's an appropriate question. However, what this bill does with the offsetting timelines that we have is it ensures that, one, pharma is still there and manufacturers show up and insurers show up and PBM representatives show up, so that we now get everybody in this corral together and can identify where the real pieces to the puzzle lie.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair and invite Representative Nose's testimony.
I'm just going to be super brief. Co-Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Johnson, Rob Noe, state representative, almost pronounced myself, for House District 42 in Southeast and a little sliver of Northeast Portland. And I am delighted to support this bill and the Dash 23 amendment that my colleagues in the Senate who have been trying to help me figure out how to get a handle on the cost of medications for Oregonians, and I hope we will pass it.
Thank you. Colleagues, any Representative Noble?
Thank you. Representative Nelson, in our discussions about this bill, when I signed on as a co-chief sponsor, you talked about some of the work you've done in the background to get to where we are today. Because of time and with not asking to rehash that, how much of what you've done in the past is what we're asking in this bill now to be done again?
Well, I think with any, thank you for your question, co-chairs, Representative Noble. I think with any task force, you know, you would be remiss to not sort of look at the work that was done by previous, you know, task force or work groups, or look at legislation that was kind of got along the way but didn't get considered. And so, you know, I would expect that we'd spend a little bit of time in the first one or two meetings sort of reviewing the lay of the land that was laid for and what became House Bill 2387 in the 2017 session. And then we'll see where it goes. There were definitely critics of that bill, and some of them are behind me. And we'll have another opportunity to try and go a little bit further. So I'm sure we'll retread a little, but I'm sure we'll also look at some new ideas.
Colleagues, any other questions? Senator Monroe.
Make sure I understand this, because it's been going on all session. I hear this rumor, another rumor, the iteration. We had the base bill, which placed some limitations. So what you are recommending doing is delaying that base bill, imposing a task force, asking the task force to review the information in the base bill, or perhaps even to propose modifications or amendments, and that if the task force fails to do that, then the base bill down the road will take effect. Is that pretty much correct?
I think you're close to it, Senator. If I might add, we're going to implement the bill. DCBS is going to go forward. The ultimate delay is the first report that is contemplated by this legislation won't come out until July 1st rather than March of 2019.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Steiner-Hayward.
The only thing I would add, Madam Chair, in response to Representative Noble's question, is that in the past, this issue has been looked at a little bit more segment by segment. Representative Noce has done a lot of admirable work around the pharmaceutical industry side of this. I've done some work over on the Senate side around the prescription benefit manager side of this. We believe that getting everybody in the same room under public records law with a process, with designated membership, and with our LPRO staff support will get us even further down the road, building on the good work that Representative Noce and many of others have done in the past 2 years.
Okay, any other questions for this panel? Senator Monroe.
Just one more. So I'm channeling my colleague here, and he asked the question, why not just do the task force? And it seems to me that the answer is that heading the direction that you outlined here will keep their feet to the fire and pretty much will force action.
I think that's a fair way to describe it, Senator Monroe. I wasn't the brainchild behind the Dash 23, so I don't want to take credit for what your colleagues in your chamber did, but I think you've accurately described it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to move us along. I'm taking these slightly out of order. We have Aaron Knott from the Department of Justice, and I would like to hear from the agency before we go into the public testimony. And unless he's out in the hallway. Okay. Next up on deck in order of signing up will be Skipper Osborne.
Here he is, Senator.
Mr. Knott, I extended to you the courtesy of hearing from the agency.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Justice, and I was down in overflow, so sorry if that took me a moment. I'm here only on the Dash 12 amendments. We are neutral on these amendments, but we did receive a fiscal request, so I wanted to give some sense of what they are because we're still sort of working through them. The Dash 12 amendments would create a new enforcement mechanism at the Attorney General's office within the Department of Justice, wherein any citizen could refer an allegation of price gouging. We would investigate, then we turn that over to the HERC, the Health Evidence Review Commission. They would have a public hearing, make their own determinations, and if they found a violation, they would return the content of that to the Attorney General's office. And they would have the ability under the Dash 12s to impose a civil penalty of at least $10,000, but no more than an amount equal to 10% of the manufacturer wholesale distributor's revenue from sales of that drug in the state. For us, this is, it's an interesting idea, but one we're still processing. We've been in these discussions for really a business day or two, but our very preliminary estimates is that in a full biennium, this would run us about $1.2 million. What that largely reflects is the lack of capacity within the existing Department of Justice to make the kind of economic analysis that you would need to make to understand price gouging. That is not a fresh out of law school calculation, and so we would need to purchase that expertise on the open market, and that's a competitive market. So mostly, since we received the fiscal request, I wanted to have the opportunity to have this dialogue with the committee since we hadn't had it otherwise, and free for any questions and very mindful of your time.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Mr. Knott and the Department of Justice? Thank you very much, Mr. Knott.
Thank you.
So now we'll take these in order of signing up. Skipper Osborne. And next up will be Jesse O'Brien. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Skipper Osborne. I graduated from Vernon Elementary School in 1964 and Jefferson High School in 1967. I received a Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration from Lewis and Clark College. And I would like to say I was the first African-American president of the undergraduate school of Lewis and Clark College. I work for the Intelligence Division for the United States Air Force, and I'm a very proud 100% disabled vet. I went 3 years toward a master's degree of divinity at George Fox University, and I went 2 years pre-law at the College of Legal Arts. I'm a licensed minister, and I'm a former president of the Portland branch, number 1120 NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. I do have a copy if you would like a copy.
Thank you. Time is very limited, so if you would paraphrase your written testimony and give it to the professional staff, they'll disseminate it to
our
the...
Our comments are about opposition to House Bill 4005, which proposes to mandate biopharmaceutical companies to disclose proprietary information. House Bill 4005 could hurt innovation in ways for companies to develop medications that could help people in the African-American community. For example, there are higher rates of breast cancer and prostate cancer in the African-American population. Also, we need to find cures for better medication for diseases such as sickle cell anemia. The measure of House Bill 405 disregard the fact that medicines are not the dominant drivers for health care growth. Healthcare spending growth is due to other factors in healthcare services such as long-term care, hospitalization, and provider services. House Bill 4005 could potentially decrease access to important therapies. We feel these new measures would neither benefit patients nor decrease healthcare costs. We strongly oppose House Bill 4005, and we are ready to work with the legislature to develop real solutions, such as go after rogue pricing, as was done with the EpiPen, which I am a user thereof. And I'm very thankful for the VA that it pays for mine. Okay. I will be actively working with members of my community to oppose House Bill 4005, and I hope that you take my comments seriously and understand the damage this bill would do in the discovery and making of pharmaceuticals. Thank you. Sincerely, most respectfully submitted, Skipper Osborne.
Thank you very much, and make sure that you give a copy to Michael and he'll disseminate it. Mr. O'Brien, please.
Chair Johnson and members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a statewide consumer advocacy group, and I'm excited to be here in support of House Bill 4005. I'm also here as a member of a broad-based coalition of organizations supporting the bill that also includes AARP and other consumer groups and teachers, nurses, and hospitals and health plans. So it's a group of pretty unlikely bedfellows. I'm not going to belabor the merits of the bill on the policy, because I think that was well debated in the policy committee. But just to say that this issue is really the number one healthcare consumer issue that we hear about from our members. The rising cost of prescription drugs has been for a few years now, and I think this bill represents something close to the least we can do to address a really serious crisis for Oregon consumers. I'll also just say, that there has been a lot of debate since the bill passed the policy committee about the timing of implementation of the legislation, and based on our initial review, the -23 amendment seems like an acceptable compromise from our perspective, so we're happy to move forward with that. And I'd also be happy to talk about any of the other amendments, but in the interest of time, I'll leave it there. But we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions of Mr. O'Brien? Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you. Thank you both, gentlemen, and Mr. Osborne, thank you so much for being here. I wanted to ask you, you're benefited to have insurance that covers the cost of your EpiPen, but my understanding, the cost of that particular unit has increased 450% since 2004, raising from about $100 to about $450. Do you have any curiosity about that change?
Representative Gomberg?
Gomberg, yes. Thank you.
Price gouging, simple as that. And that those are the people that we need to go after, the ones that do the price gouging, because I feel that this bill is casting a net over all pharmaceutical companies, and I feel it's going to increase the price. If I recall the statement from Senator Lithcomb, he was saying something about $1 billion to do the research on this. Who's going to absorb that cost?
All right, thank you very much, sir.
Colleagues, any other questions for these two witnesses? Thank you very much. The next folks that have signed up are Mr. Gardner and Ms. McCarthy. And there is, I believe, an overflow room, and so I would extend the courtesy of an invitation to sign up to offer testimony to those in the overflow room. Michael, we can put this sheet back out again if you don't mind. I want to make sure that we get everybody. I jammed everybody through time-wise, expecting every single person in the room to have an offering, and that may not be the case. So we'll start with you, Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Gardner, and I represent the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. And I really appreciate the patience that everyone has shown, the deliberation, et cetera. And what I want to stress is really the question that Senator Hansel asked, which is the order, the sequence in which we address this issue. I think it makes sense to do the study first, because the base bill, the big flaw in the base bill, is it singles out one entity in the supply chain and leaves everybody else in terms of transparency off the hook. That is not meaningful transparency. If you don't have formulary transparency, PBM transparency, that is not meaningful. And it's not the kind of information that is really beneficial to patients. Maybe to Dun and Bradstreet, but not to patients. So I think that you ought to seriously consider doing this study. Is going to be on a fast track anyway. That was clear from the testimony. To do that first and then act in 2019 in a way that deals with the entire supply chain. I think there's a real risk if you don't do that, that you're going to have tendency toward inertia or resistance on the part of those who will not be affected by the base bill come the effective date of it. The other thing I want to just note, and I believe that the question was asked earlier, is there an element of price control in this bill? Not yet, but it has been made very clear by many of the proponents that this is step one. And I think for all of those reasons, having a procedural safeguard of doing the study first really makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Mr. Gardner or Representative Nierman?
Very quickly. So you're representing the pharmaceutical industry. There's two places in here. One of them I see in the Dash 12, which I don't think have been adopted, which if a pharmaceutical company's guilty of price gouging, their fine is $10,000 but no more than an amount equal to 10% of the manufacturer's revenue from that state. Under the in the A and Gross version, it also talks about a $10,000 per day fine for not reporting correctly or anything like that can be assessed by DCBS. What impact is that going to have on the price of drugs if those fines?
Madam Chair, Representative Nierman, it's going to push it up.
Thank you.
Other questions, Ms. McCarthy.
Madam Chair and Co-Chair Gombard and Joint Committee members, my name is Denise McCarty. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Bioscience Association. I'm here with member companies to oppose HB 4005, and I'm going to read fast.
The crisis is over. I thought everybody was going to speak, and that's why, and the House was going to be leaving right now. Crisis abated, so I
shouldn't have scribbled so much.
You're welcome to breathe between sentences.
As you know, the state has generously invested in life sciences. One such investment was the creation of the Oregon Translational Research and Development Institute, also known as OTRADI, and the Bioscience Incubator. The research center is now home to 19 life sciences startup companies that in the last 2.5 years have created 120 jobs within those 19 startups, raised $515 million in private angel and venture capital funding, generated $22.7 million in revenue payments from corporate partners, been awarded $38 million in grants, SBIR and STTR non-dilutive funding, and engaged in 12 corporate or pharma partnerships. I'd also like to point your attention to on record, there is a letter from Design Medics, a small therapeutic drug development state that's housed with ourselves, our organization, in the Portland State Business Accelerator that is developing a therapeutic for malaria and drug resistance. HB 4005, we run the risk of stalling the return on investment the state has already made in life sciences and sends a signal to potential investors that capital is better employed in other industries and perhaps even other states. The bill also fails to take into consideration the entire supply chain or protect the private, confidential, or trade secret information of companies. Also, I want to note, I am not here today to ask you for public funds, rather to express my concern that HB 4005 would have a chilling effect on economic development that's happening in our state. For the first time, I'm thrilled to report that we have private investment happening in infrastructure with one of our partners, Summit Development, a private developer. They are building their first private investment bio building, which is 30,000 square feet, located in the Central East Side industrial area, and it reflects $25 million of private investment. And as you know, as a cautionary tale, a few years ago, one of the companies that graduated from our incubator ended up in Washington State because there was no privately held and or wet lab space in the Portland metropolitan area for them to go to. They've had such a great overwhelming response, they actually are in the middle of purchasing, negotiating to purchase a second full block project that would include 200,000 square feet of mixed lab space and office space, and have a letters of intent today totaling 70,000 square feet, which is an additional $78 million of private investment. Oregon Bio is committed to a constructive dialogue and a holistic debate that encourages investment in Oregon that keeps our small, innovative companies competitive in the global market. Remain deeply concerned about the proposal that would stifle future innovation and possibly disrupt the momentum of the economic development of life sciences and the return on investment the state has made in the sector to date. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for Ms. McCarty? I would thank you for bringing to the committee's attention to OTRADI. For our colleagues that are new, OTRADI was one of several elements included in a thing called Oregon Inc., Oregon Innovation, and it was the opportunity to draw on indigenous strengths that Oregon had and try to capitalize economically. It included the built environment with BEST, Onami, that was nanotechnology, partnering with the universities. Otrati, which is, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the only one of these initiatives that's self-sustaining and has is weaning itself away from state support through earned revenue. Took over a building and fully subscribed it almost immediately. Dr. Jennifer Fox, I believe, is still the head of Otrati. And perhaps you could comment a little bit on that irony of, on the one hand, we are, at least according to your testimony, on the one hand, we're making public investment and state investment in these initiatives that showcase Oregon's indigenous strength. And then, if I understood your testimony correctly, you're saying that the passage of this bill could have a chilling effect on the kind of research being done by Otrati member companies. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And for the record, yes, Jennifer Fox. Dr. Fox is the executive director still of the Oregon Bioscience Incubator and Otrati as well. The concern is that oftentimes I make the joke that I do everything but go to the airport and send smoke signals to capital investors to stop in our state. We tend to be a flyover state. They tend to start in San Jose and perhaps fly right over Oregon and go to Seattle. So it's one of the things that we struggle with constantly is attracting capital and venture capital to our state. The private investment in infrastructure is a tipping point, and we've never had that before. And it's exciting to have perhaps a graduation space for the companies that are graduating out of Otrati so they don't leave the state. So it is a struggle to attract capital here, yes. So if making a choice with my funds and my capital, would I go to a state that appears to be and or could be offering a situation where I would have to reveal trade secrets perhaps with this bill, or would I take my funds somewhere else? And that is a concern because it's a struggle for us to attract private capital.
One more question, if you would indulge
yes.
me, and that is in the dash 23s, the list of appointees to the task force, do you have confidence if this bill passes that the bioscience sector and Otrati, that your interests would be represented at the table?
Thank you, Coach Johnson, and yes.
Okay. All right, colleagues, any other questions of either Ms. McCarty or Mr. Gardner? Thank you very much. Next up, Vince Porter, please. And Michael, are there any other late entrants on the sign-in sheet? Good afternoon, Mr. Porter.
Good afternoon.
Okay, this will be last call for anybody in this room or anybody in the overflow hearing room to testify on House Bill 4005-A.
Chair Johnson, Chair Gomberger, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vince Porter. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Cambia Health Solutions. We manage the region's health plan here in Oregon. And I just want to comment on two things. One about the task force question. The formation of House Bill 4005 is the result of over 2 years of work with Representative Nose and quite a few members that were involved in a task force to work through and figure out what is the first step to addressing. So we would urge you to consider that we have started a task force. We support continuing the conversation, but we feel like this is the first product of the first step. The other part I would like to address is the issue of transparency, and just remind everyone that all health plans today have transparency requirements to file their rates to DCBS every year. And our requirements take it one step further than what we're asking the pharmaceutical manufacturers to do in this bill. We are reviewed by the department to submit our rates to the individual market. They have public hearings. They review the rates. They check in with our actuaries to verify whether or not they're actuarially sound. And they have the authority to reject our rates. They can tell us that the rates are too high and force us to lower those rates, or they can tell us they're too low, or they're telling us just fine. So there already is, in one of the three legs of the healthcare stool, a transparency requirement and also an enforcement that this bill is not a part of.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Representative Nierman.
So thank you, Mr. Porter. So you say there's transparency for rates, but we're talking about pharmaceuticals here. Do you have to disclose the rebates or the discounts that you get from drug manufacturers?
We're required to file all the justifications of our costs and what is what is part of the DCBS's requirements under the ACA. Also, I want to point out in the bill, we are going to be required, and we are fine with it, reporting our top 25 cost of drugs and also the top 25 prescribed drugs in the bill as well. So we are also included in this bill in terms of reporting requirements.
So can I follow up? So you're currently required to disclose rebates and discounts that you get from pharmaceutical manufacturers and or PBMs?
I don't have the specific answers to you to that question. I know that as part of the rate review process, that DCBS has the authority to ask us how we justify our individual market.
Okay.
Other questions of Mr. Porter? How fortuitous that you should mention DCBS, because I think we have just been joined by the new director. Are you desirous of testifying, Mr. Director? Take that as a yes.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and just want to speak briefly to how we envision implementing House Bill 4005. In our initial fiscals, we have three positions, one operation and policy analyst, a research analyst, and an admin specialist to implement this program. We have looked at, on the S&S side, services and supplies, adapting existing IT systems, which has a smaller cost than new ones, so solves the IT problems both on the reporting and on any of the complaints coming in, as well as a small DOJ cost, whether on enforcement actions or also on disclosures that can be appealed to the Attorney General. I would say with the Dash 23 amendments shifting the deadlines from March 15th as the first reporting in 2019 to a July 1st, 2019 would likely lessen the fiscal that is still yet to be submitted on that amendment. The positions we're looking at being phased in on July 1st of this year, that would likely be delayed under the Dash 23 amendment. But happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for the director? Yes, Representative Verdon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. I've just been curious with a question. I don't know if you're the right person to ask, but I'll try. So your analyst, I would assume, could they detect if there was price shifting of some kind? So let's say that manufacturer was restricted or limited on how much they could raise the price of one drug. Could they just raise prices across the board if they have a portfolio of products and maintain their profitability in that respect?
Co-chairs, Representative Reardon, there is no cap on what prices could be set, simply a transparency action out of this bill. So all of those costs could be increased on one drug significantly, but that would still be visible and reported on.
Follow-up.
So the visibility would be on the portfolio of products they have, or you're just looking at the one product?
Co-chairs, Representative Reardon, only on those that have a price increase would be reported.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Please give your name for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Co-chairs Johnson and Gomberg and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, policy manager with the Division of Financial Regulation. I was really here as the lifeline for the director, so I have no testimony.
Thank you. Any questions for the lifeline, colleagues? Thank you for joining us today. All right. Thank you, Mr. Director. All right, colleagues, it is now 1:58. 2:01 becomes the magic time when we could consider any amendments. I'm going to make one last call for testimony in an overflow room just in case, so they have the opportunity to come down, but not much of an opportunity. And I will ask Ms. Toe, may you begin your analysis before 2:01, or do we need to?
Yes, we can do that. I'll talk slowly.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, as you've heard, HB 4005 establishes the Prescription Drug Price Transparency Act, requiring manufacturers of prescription drugs sold in Oregon to report specified information to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The bill also requires insurers to include specified information regarding reimbursement of certain drugs, along with current filing of health insurance rates. The bill authorizes DCBS to establish fees to be paid by manufacturers to pay the cost of carrying out the provisions of this bill. The measure previously had hearings in the House Committee on Healthcare on February 5th and February 9th. And based on the number of manufacturers currently licensed by the Oregon Board of Pharmacy and the National Trends in Prescription Drug Pricing, DCPS projects the cost of complying with the provisions of this bill to be $425,000 and $25,022 other funds, three positions, 1.5 FTE for the 2017-19 biennium, and $577,120 other funds, three positions, three FTEs for the 2019-21 biennium. And funding for this program will be derived from fees paid to the DCBS by manufacturers. Such fees will be set via rulemaking and are yet to be determined. And LFO recommends the following that you adopt the following four amendments. The dash A1 amendment makes one small clarifying language change. It just adds to dispensing drugs dispensed to patients, and it adds three words, and other persons. And the A13 amendment adds the limitation of $425 and 22 other funds to the bill for DCBS to establish and implement this program. And the dash A15 amendment specifies a March 15th, 2019 starting date for the reporting of new prescription drugs information by manufacturers to DCBS. And it sets March 15th, 2019 as operative date for provisions related to manufacturers' reporting requirements. And the dash A23, which you heard about, further clarifies some reporting dates and establishes an 18-member task force on the fair pricing of prescription drugs, charged with developing a strategy to create transparency for drug prices across the supply chain, including insurers, pharmacy benefit managers, distributors, wholesale and retail pharmacies.
Thank you, Ms. Toh. The only question that I have is, you made reference to the A1 amendment. Is it A1 or A11?
A11, I'm sorry.
Let the record reflect it's the A11. Okay. So your LFO report would recommend adoption of the A11, the A13, the A15, and the A23. Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Toh? It is now 2:01. Any questions of Ms. Toh? Okay. There being none, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. I just want to say, first of all, I really appreciate the work that everybody has done to bring us these amendments today. For anybody that's been listening in concerned about the pace with which we've addressed these options at this committee level, I'll remind everyone that there were two policy hearings that have been conducted previously, and our main task here is to address the fiscal aspects of the various amendments. I have a procedural question. Should I be making a motion for amendments one at a time, or should I be making a motion to approve the recommendation of LFO to adopt the four amendments?
Co-Chair Comfort, you can do the four amendments as one, and then I will have it combined as one amendment before it gets to the full.
All right.
You can say 11, 13, 15, and 23.
I'd like to vote against two and for two of them, so I'd prefer that they come one at a time. Is that okay?
Fine. Then as a courtesy to a colleague, we'll do them one at a time.
Very good. And Madam Co-Chair, I would move that we accept the recommendation of staff to adopt the A11 amendment.
Colleagues, you have heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion to accept the LFO recommendation to incorporate the A11 into House Bill 4005. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Representative Gomberg.
Madam Co-Chair, I would move to accept the recommendation to adopt the A13 amendment.
Colleagues, you have heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion to adopt the A3 amendments in the 13, House. 13. Or 13? God, I just did it. Into the A13 amendments into House Bill 4005. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I would move to accept the recommendation to adopt the A15 amendment.
Colleagues, the motion to adopt the A15 amendments into House Bill 4005. The motion has been made. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? Representative Nierman marked as an objection. Adopted.
Co-Chair, thank you. I would move to accept the recommendation to adopt the A23 amendment.
Colleagues, Co-Chair Gomberg has moved the A23 amendments into House Bill 4005. Any questions? Any question? Representative Noble.
Discussion. Or actually, just a comment. In the spirit of what Representative Gomberg mentioned, this has been a great, lively
discussion regarding policy, and it's unfortunate that none of it came up during the policy committee.
Representative Nierman.
Yeah, so I agree with that, and then I liked Representative Hansel's suggestion that maybe do the task force, or maybe it was Representative or Senator Monroe, that we do the task force first and then do the substantive bill. So and I would say make a comment that this bill is a poster child for something not to do in the short session, but we have too many posters now piling up. So
okay, colleagues, any other questions or discussion? Any objections to the A23s? Representative Nierman recorded as an objection. The A23s are adopted.
Madam Co-Chair, are you ready for a final motion?
I am, sir.
All right. In that case, I would move adoption of House Bill 4005 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, Co-Chair Gomberg has moved the adoption of the amended 4005, House Bill 4005, amended by the dash 11s, the dash 13s, the dash 15s, and the dash 23s move forward with a due pass recommendation, move forward to full with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any discussion?
Yes, please.
Representative Noble.
Thank you, Senator. When I signed on to this bill, it's because I believed in the underlying idea that we right now need some transparency and some drug pricing. There was some examples cited. One I cited in my testimony was the idea of fighting the opioid epidemic and putting naloxone in the hands of first responders, yet naloxone's gone up 500% since we did that. I have some grave concerns, and it's reflected in my questions. I am not supportive in any way, I want to put this on the record, that this does not set up an expectation, nor does this task force ever have the authority or responsibility to set any type of price controls, price control systems, that it simply is for transparency. The other concern I have brought up trade secrets, and as the bill sponsor mentioned, I think I want to set on the legislative record as well that there is no expectation that any part of this supply chain that we're talking about in pharmaceuticals would have to give up a trade secret or somehow reduce their ability to do their primary function and job in the process.
Thank you very much, Representative Nierman.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I share Representative Noble's reservations about this bill. I'd add to that just the unevenness of the fact that this takes on the pharmaceutical manufacturers but doesn't take into account the pharmacy benefit managers or the health care plans. I mean, it does in the task force, but it concerns me that maybe that the original bill was kind of one-sided, and then I'm concerned that the outcome might be one-sided.
That is a perfect segue into my comment for the record, and that is the responsibility of the task force to be balanced. In looking at the appointees, I think that there is an obligation to make sure that there is the opportunity for a complete and thoughtful conversation at the task force table, and that the appointing authorities, who are the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House and the Governor, ensure a process that is, again, open and transparent and solicits names that would result in a balanced conversation about this issue that is of enormous concern to Oregonians. But if the task force is grossly lopsided in any way, I think it will diminish the public receptivity to the work product that they deliver. All right, so with that, we have a motion, and I would call for any objections. Representative Nierman and Senator Hansel are recorded as objecting to the motion. The motion is carried, and amended House Bill 4005 now moves to full. Do we have volunteers for carriers?
Elizabeth Steiner.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. On the Senate side, I have a specific request that Senator Steiner Hayward take it to full, and she and Senator Lithicum would be co-carriers on the Senate side. And it seems as though, Representative Noce, you've done the time in the trenches. We would be honored to have you carry it on the House side.
Honored to carry it, too.
All right. Colleagues, that concludes our. Well, no, it doesn't. We still have a work session. I see all the low-dot faces back there.
Madam Co-Chair, I think we need to close the work session and move into the information session.
Yes, just two moments. Steiner Hayward will take it to full. And co-carry with Lithicum and Nose on the House floor.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I apologize to the audience for making this such a forced pace. I had fully expected that there would be much more testimony, and so for those of you that truncated your testimony, thank you for your courtesy. We'll close the work session on House Bill 4005 and open an informational session on transportation package positions and expenditure limitation request, Mr. Garrett and Mr. Mathers. And
Madam Co-Chair, if I could just mention, House members have been in session since quarter to the hour, so we are going to excuse ourselves so we can take care of business there.
Thank you very much. Noted, excused. And Mr. Jolivet, if you would open the conversation, we would appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is, as you said, an informational session, and so we're basically providing our an overview of the request and an indication of what the LFO's recommendation is on this. So ODOT is requesting a total of $195.5 million other funds expenditure limitation and 179 positions. The LFO notes, and as you'll see in the handouts, that most of the funding and the positions are proposed to go to the Highway Division, which is the project delivery arm of the department. Of the 179 positions requested, 127 would go to the Highway Division. It's also notable that if you look at the breakdown of the $195.5 million requests by expense category, you'll see that only $14.2 million is for personal services, about 7%, with a balance of $181.7 million in services and supplies and special payments, which largely reflects contract services for project delivery, grants to public transit, and the Connect program. The LFO, in its review, finds that the request is consistent with the requirements of House Bill 2017. It does focus on timely project delivery, which is a legislative priority, as you know. And the position request, though large, is reasonable in light of the proposed increase, or the increase that House Bill 2017 represents in the base project delivery program. The LFO notes, however, that the agency timeline for filling the requested positions appears a bit ambitious. So the LFO is recommending a reduced level of expenditures, $117.5 million, rather than the $195.6 million requested. And that's really just to align the revenues and the expenditures. Specifically, LFO is proposing to reduce the request for public transit and for Connect, as the revenue for those components of the package are not currently available to fund those components. And that concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Good afternoon again.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for your patience.
No, Madam Chair, I appreciate it, and appreciate this opportunity. Again, for the record, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. With me is Paul Mather, the Division Administrator. I think Mr. Jolivet obviously articulated the depth and breadth of this investment package and how we intend to deliver it, and with his mention that the significant portion going to the highway portfolio, specifically the project delivery side, how do you roster up for such a thing? What are the challenges? And Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is have Mr. Mather kind of walk through the way we have positioned this conversation, since that's the largest ask during the 17-19 biennium.
Madam Chair, Member of the Committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I'm just going to spend a few minutes just kind of walk through the methodology we use to come up with our approach to delivering the projects, the numbers of positions, the distribution of those positions, and finally how those positions get assigned to specific projects. And I'll end with a little bit on our strategies to fill these positions in a market that's a very competitive job market. Over a year ago, as House Bill 2017 was beginning to take shape, we sat down with our industry partners, ACEC and the consultants, and began discussions on how would we deliver what ultimately became House Bill 2017. Consultants, ACEC has been a valuable partner of the department in delivering past funding packages in OTIA and JTA. And we learned from those experiences and talked about those experiences with them. We also included members that they brought from other states, Washington and Nevada specifically, that also had very large packages, and we learned from their experiences in delivering those packages. The first thing we did with them is to agree on five principles that we were going to use. As the package took shape, what are the guiding principles we're going to use to land in our delivery methodology? Of those five guiding principles, the first one was we knew we needed appropriately sized and skilled ODOT staff. Second, we needed to streamline and have a reliable procurement process. The third one was we needed a strong owner role for ODOT. And I'll describe that a little bit in that as you're a consultant or a contractor working for an agency, you need decisions. The decisions are very important that you get timely and quality decisions so you can be successful in your work. And having a qualified person at the agency that's able to make those decisions was just as important to us as it was to our consultants and to our contractors.
Mr. Mather, let me stop you there and just ask a question. How much power do you vest in your project managers to make those kind of go, no-go decisions? I know that when the Transportation Committee was out in Woodburn and we were looking at a project that everybody takes justifiable pride in, that one of the things that you perhaps personally called to our attention was the nimbleness of the contractors and the ability to get those go, no-go decisions right away. Could you speak a little bit about how that decision tree works and how you liberate your project people to make timely decisions?
Yeah, Chair Johnson, formally we have delegated authorities that we formally delegate authorities actually from our commission to the director to myself and on down to our project managers to make those timely decisions, both from a cost standpoint, an approach standpoint, and a specification standpoint. And we rely on our inspectors, our frontline inspectors, our assistant project managers, and our project managers to make those decisions. Their relationship and working relationship that they establish with the contractor are vital to the success of our projects, in particular the one you cited in Woodburn. That relationship that our local office had with K&E in delivering that project was vital. For a successful project, we realize that that project comes first, but to do that, we need to have a qualified staff on our side that is able to work well with the contractor and do what's best for the project itself. Just continuing on the five principles, the fourth one was we needed to work on streamlining our project delivery process. And the fifth one was we knew that we needed to have a lot of tools in our toolbox in delivering this program, and not just our traditional design bid build low bid process. We needed to have the capability to do things such as design build or CMGC or combinations thereof that, again, that fit the project appropriately that come out of the package. From there, we worked on three different delivery scenarios, and the first two were really just kind of bookends to help inform our discussion. The first one was, so what if we had no new positions? What would that look like for the department? And how does that stack up against those five principles I just cited? With no new positions, we would turn essentially into a contract administration agency where the almost 100% of the work would be outsourced. We would be proficient at administering those contracts, but it would be one that would violate that strong owner role, and our expertise in transportation would diminish over time as our skills would be devoted to administering the contracts.
And Mr. Mather, perhaps you could comment on some of the oversight. And this is not meant to be beat up on ODOT time. You guys have got your plate full, and you should be commended for picking up the load you're picking up. But there have been a couple of projects recently where I don't know exactly the relationship between the people delivering the project and the contract oversight. What I'm trying to get at is, for a long time, ODOT was build them out of the mud, and you guys had the engineers, you had the people, you did the projects. You designed them, you built them, you executed on project management. And then you started subbing out a little, and that changes the character, at least in my opinion, changes the character of the oversight. Instead of having engineers drawing things, you had contract managers. What's the mix this time, and how do you assure that you're hiring the right people, particularly when you're subbing out some of the work, to know that you've got project managers with the appropriate skill set to be contract administrators rather than highway designers?
Chair Johnson, you hit the kind of the nail on the head. As I get to the third scenario, that's exactly where we landed in our delivery scenario. To develop that and to answer that question, one of the things we did was look back at past programs such as JTA and OTIA. What were the peak levels of outsourcing that we were at, and how did that balance between outsourcing and in-housing our projects and having the expertise on staff? How did that work in those programs? We landed on a 70% outsourcing scenario, and that was the peak of the OTIA program. We were at that 70%. And that is where 70% of the work would be done through consultants and 30% would be done in-house. We also look back in developing that scenario. We look back over the last several bienniums. There was about 200 positions that we turned back in as we came down. If you've seen my presentations on the mountain chart and the kind of the downhill side of the programs I just talked about, the JTA and the OTIA, as we were coming down the back side of those programs, we were doing the same analysis I'm going to describe here in a minute. And realized we had more positions than we had workload, and we were turning positions back in. And that was about 200 positions. And so the scenario that we brought forward and is embedded in the work that we have here is a 70% outsourcing model. We believe that that satisfies the principles that I just described, keeps a strong owner role, but also is an appropriate-sized ODOT staff, and relies on the reinstatement of those 200 positions that I talked about.
Does your assumption take into consideration that right now the whole marketplace is red hot and that you are looking to some of the same external firms that are so busy they're chasing their own tails?
Chair Johnson, that's a concern both on the consulting side and frankly on the construction side as well. We have a booming economy, and there's a lot of work in the private sector and the public sector as well as our neighboring states. That's a challenge we're going to have to work through and grow not only our staff but the consultant staff as well as the contract community to be successful.
Have you also factored into your deliberations how much overtime you're going to be asking of your people and how to spread workload across those folks so you don't burn them up and send them off to CalDOT that's also recruiting now?
Yeah. Senator Johnson, that's a concern. I'll get into a little bit of that here in my presentation as I talk about the specifics of projects, but those are all concerns that our managers are working through. It's a case-by-case basis around the state and our regions as we have different projects and different expectations to match up the expertise of our staff with the specific needs of projects, mentor and develop staff so they can grow into having additional skill sets to accomplish not only the projects in front of them, but projects that we have coming in the future.
Madam Chair, if I may, I just think you have hit on a line of questioning that is probably the greatest challenge we have before us. You have mentioned that we have a lot of people fishing in the same pond, and everybody wants that blue chip project manager, want that seasoned individual in terms of project delivery. That's just not only in the state, as you said, but the state of Washington, California, Nevada, and Idaho. All these states have made investment in transportation over the last several years. So the issue is, how do we get out in front of that? Well, the first thing we need to do is ensure that our compensation levels are in alignment when we have some challenges in there. We've done some market study with the Department of Administrative Services that show in the project delivery discipline, our professional engineers and such, we're out of alignment somewhere between 13% and 17%. So we're having an administrative conversation to just on a financial playing field, become level with the folks in California, in Washington. Because we have seen, while I spoke to earlier, our movement in filling the 35.63 FTEs we got in the 17 session, we're moving forward. Well, we're out of the gate sooner than kind of the private sector sector here in the state of Oregon, as well as the local governments. But we have lost positions to Caltrans, just to be blunt. We had a finalist for a senior position up in Portland metropolitan region, a region we're challenged with if you look at the delivery portfolio. The good folks in at Caltrans made an offer that was 25% higher than our highest offer we can make. So we're trying to, again, play on many different unlevel playing fields here. And then if past is prologue, the OTIA experience, we saw a lot of folks move on from our agency to the private sectors. We also have a wave now.
Some of your senior managers.
Some of my senior managers, absolutely. We're also seeing retirements of those senior managers at higher percentages than kind of the workforce themselves. So we do have some challenges. We're positioning ourselves. We're going to take some risks in terms of moving people into positions, trying to expose them, see if they can hit the pitching. This is a risk management discipline, but it is a risk that we have to deal with here. So we're playing that across the board. One of the things that you may have heard from our private sector partners, we need a competent, diverse, qualified workforce in order for us to be successful, but maybe most importantly, in order for them to be successful, as the private sector, again, 100% of the delivering the projects, constructing the projects, go to the private sector firms that we deal with here. So we're trying to make sure we roster up the appropriate people so we can complement the professionals on the private sector side.
One of the things that I'm going to ask the professional staff to flag, and maybe we'd hear from you again briefly during legislative days, is how are the recruitments going? And I would just share the cautionary tale that one of your sister agencies characterized their own report to us as a little too clever. And it was that they were in the process of filling 30 positions. Well, that meant they had help wanted signs out. I think that we, as your partners, the legislature, would appreciate a truthful report. You know, we got 50 solicitations on the street, and we've had a nibble on one.
Right.
I'd rather know that from you up front than have to peel the onion back to find out that recruitment does not mean for hire.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate that honest approach. We're not going to hide the ball. As a matter of fact, I feel like I jumped ahead in Mr. Mather's presentation, but he was going to open the kimono, so to speak. As we look forward, especially as we move beyond 17 and 19, and when the major projects really start to animate from House Bill 2017, as we move into the 1921 and then beyond, the professional staff, the competent staff that we need, we're going to run into those challenges, and we're going to have straightforward and honest conversations with you and your colleagues.
Thank you. I don't know how much we've interrupted you, Mr. Mather. You got 4 minutes left.
Yeah. I'll just make a couple more points, Chair Johnson. I guess one thing that we are seeing on the positive side of this equation is that Oregon is still a desirable place for people to live. And we see an in-migration of people coming into Oregon.
You think that Delta's worth 25% salary? Rhetorical question.
We have to be, I think the director's comments and your comment, we got to be in the game from a salary standpoint. But as long as we're in the game from a salary standpoint, Oregon has a lot to offer, especially rural Oregon. We offer a lot of positions in our regional offices and our district offices where people that want that lifestyle in rural Oregon, we offer a well-paying job in rural Oregon. Where we're challenged that we've been talking about is in the Portland metro areas where we specifically have those challenges. The last point I'll make is we go through the analysis of these positions and our workload every other year. That's an ongoing process. As I alluded to earlier, at some points we come back and say we got more people than we have workload. And then the opposite can be true, too. We need more people to go with our workload. And so we're going to be back and having those conversations with this committee and the bienniums to come as we hit those triggers in the bill. If we're successful on those triggers or when we are successful on those triggers and we're back here, we'll be having those discussions, learning from what we've learned in the first couple years in implementing this bill and applying those lessons to additional needs that we may have.
One concluding remark from me is that I probably read your data as well as anybody. I've been around ODOT for a long time. But I think for external observers not understanding exactly the differential between your personal services and your services and supplies, particularly where some of this is going to be going out in grants.
Right.
And the two things that have always bugged me about that is that the disaggregation, so you know how much is really just pass through. You guys have had a tendency to swap money occasionally, and I've never been able to follow that. But then last but not least is the degree of oversight in that pass-through. And I think House Bill 2017 speaks to a higher level of rigor in you looking at how well some of those grants are administered, mm-hmm. Particularly in the transit area where suddenly there is this huge influx of money. And I think for some of us, the expectation that the transit division be run as professionally as possible.
I'll be very brief here, but Madam Chair, it's an excellent point. What you're seeing with the infusion of transit money, really a doubling of a budget that's about $100 million, and with the new transit privilege tax payroll tax that's coming in, you're seeing a little over $100 million flowing into that portfolio. We've done a couple things. One, we've tried to bring additional scrutinies as we crafted the rules. Again, who's overseeing who? How are we monitoring? I also made the decision to bring the Secretary of State's office into this. They have what is known as a real-time audit. And it seems to me if we're standing up a brand new program that brings $100 million plus to it, let's bring the Secretary of State's office at the beginning of this construct and see if we stay in our lanes as we move and animate and deliver this project. I think that level of scrutiny is necessary, is needed as we stand this up, and just given our conversations over the many years, let's bring a discipline and a rigor that we can speak with some confidence of how we're running the transit portfolio and how are we dealing with the various providers that range across the continuum of professional activity.
All right. We have reached our allotted time. I apologize for the truncated opportunity for you guys to make your presentation. We are out of time. Colleagues, anything else? Mr. Jolivet?
Nothing.
We're adjourned.
So based on your comment, I'm thinking.